Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we began yesterday our discussion about the refutation of Mayavad. Srila Jiva Goswami basically is applying what we've learnt from the first two verses from the seventh chapter of the first canto, the first two verses dealing with Vyasa's trance, that is 174 and 5. First canto, chapter 7, verses 4 and 5, describing how he realized Krishna and how he saw the living entities and Maya. So this description then that we're reading through now, from verse 34 through to about verse 43, I think, they are mainly based on those verses, the refutations being offered of the Mayavad philosophy. So, as far as Mayavad itself is concerned, we mentioned yesterday that there are two very prominent forms of Mayavad, Paricheda and Pratibimba. Paricheda means that Brahman has become divided by upadis, and Pratibimba means that Brahman has become reflected in upadis. Upadis, in upadis, and externally has apparently assumed the forms of those upadis. So on the board today, we have written just a few little words of explanation there. Whether the Mayavadi, these two varieties of Mayavadi, whether they think Brahman has been divided or reflected, they all agree, the classic Mayavadis at least, they all agree that it has been either divided or reflected into these things. Yeah. It's just the procedure which they may differ on, division or reflection. But the specific upadis, those illusory conditioning, limiting things which are covering and apparently taking the place of Brahman, they're the same. So they're written up on the board there. There's five factors, basically. First is avidya. Somehow, Brahman or some part of Brahman becomes affected by avidya. Avidya means ignorance. Under the influence of that ignorance, that part of Brahman thinks that he, she, or it, or whatever, is now a jiva. And then enters into a state based on that influence of ignorance, enters into a state of illusion, Maya. Then, following that, not before, but the next stage is that another part of Brahman becomes covered, this time by goodness, and becomes like a very high-level upadi, a high-level illusory concept or illusory non-existent, well anyway, existent or non-existent, that is a subject we're going to be looking at, but an entity or category of entity called the Ishvara category. That means what This is all according to the Mayavadis, of course, particularly Shankaracharya. What we would normally call God, or the Vishnu Tattva. This Ishvara category of Upadi is not transcendental, as we would say the Vishnu Tattva is, the Ishvara Tattva, but almost transcendental, but not quite, on a very high level of the mode of goodness. And as such, even though that part of Brahman, in order to have become the Ishvara, has been influenced by Maya. But that influence of Maya has been, it's more like voluntarily accepted. So that Ishvara is generally considered by the Mayavadis to not really be so much, if at all, or hardly at all, influenced by Maya. In fact, generally, it is controlling Maya. Yeah. The Ishvara principle is controlling Maya and controlling the living entities also through Maya, through their karma. And that Ishvara possesses the fifth principle, which is vidya, or knowledge. And through that knowledge, the jivas can realize that they are Brahman, and then they can just realize they're Brahman. Not exactly return, as we would say, in a kind of the sense of a geographical change of position, go back to Godhead, but just realize. Yes, it's like this. There are many different types of Mayavadis. They may have different ideas about Krishna. But the classical Mayavadis, they see Krishna as part of the Ishvara, Tattva, Ishvara category. Yeah. The embodiment of goodness, the embodiment of knowledge. Somehow Brahman has accepted that position due to the influence of Maya, but is not really under the control of Maya. So therefore they're able to liberate others or help others to become liberated. Yeah. That's part of it, yeah. Panchapasana, worshipping. It generally means the Vishnu Tattva. It may include some demigods, some big demigods. So this is the basic sort of picture that the Mayavadis have of what happens to Brahman, the different manifestations which, when we think of the material world, this is what has happened, this is what has gone on. Brahman has either been divided into these different categories or is being reflected. But one way or another, there are these five. So, we are just speaking in very simple and very general terms here. Yeah, we are not attempting to go into the intricacies of it. Some of it may not appear so clear, actually, so easily understandable. The reason for that is that it cannot be understood like this, because it isn't true, and it is a manifestation of the confusion of the Mayavadis. Therefore, if it doesn't make good sense to you, that's probably good. And if you think, yes, this is the way it is, then maybe you're a Mayavadi. Okay. All right, so we read then of these verses dealing with Mayavad. Yesterday we read 34, 35, and 36. 34 was really just an introduction In fact, it's just an introduction. It's nothing to do with like a statement as far as Mayavada is concerned. 35 is a very clear statement about Mayavada. And we talked about this yesterday. How Mayavada, on a very fundamental level, this is a very basic type of picture of what Mayavada is trying to put across, but how it doesn't make sense. This, of course, is Jiva Goswami's idea to explain to us how it doesn't make sense. So here in 35, he's saying, on a very fundamental level, it doesn't make sense. That if there is only one Brahman, it is not only is it all-pervading, it cannot be divided, even if you tried. It couldn't be divided. It couldn't be degraded materially because it's completely pure spirit. Somehow or other, it is the foundation of material illusion. It is not affected by it, but it is the foundation of it. But it also embodies knowledge, which is what you can become liberated through. So, this is like a fundamental picture of what they're trying to say on a very simple level. So he says, if all this is true, and they say it is, then it is not logical that Brahman could fall into Maya. Part of Brahman, a reflection of it, a divided part of it, and become the jiva. It wouldn't be possible if Brahman is really like that. So then in 36, he just tells us about these two types of Mayavadis, those who think that Brahman has become divided and those who think that it has become reflected. So let us now go on with 37. And he is now going to explain further the defects. Whether you are on the Pariched side or Pratibimba side doesn't make a big difference. But the basic point is that these upadis that we've written on the board are there somehow or other. So first of all, he starts off by saying in 37, if we assume that these upadis are empirically real and not illusory, this is a very important point or beginning place. If we are to say that these upadis written on the board here are real, they actually exist, and they're not illusions, still, because Brahman is not affected by anything, it cannot be delimited by them or divided. It cannot be divided by them, because Brahman is Brahman. Moreover, if you're on the Pratibimba side, the reflective side, Brahman can cast no reflection because it is devoid of attributes. It is all-pervading and it is indivisible. Since Brahman has no attributes, it can have no relation with upadis. Since it is all-pervading, it cannot be divided into a reflected object and its reflection. And since it is indivisible and uniform, it cannot be seen. In these respects, Brahman resembles the sky. Because the sky is invisible, reflections are cast not by the sky itself, but by limited luminous parts of the sky. In fact, I don't really like that. By limited luminous things in the sky, namely the heavenly bodies or planets or stars like that. So they are not part of the sky, they're in the sky. Yeah. So in our commentary here, the point is, first of all, we are considering if the upadis are real. Those things which divide. In other words, our bodies. Our bodies, we said yesterday, in the dividing Pariched concept, they're like the pots. The sky is in the pot and outside the pot. The sky inside is not different from the sky outside. And if we think that it is because the pot is there, and now the sky has somehow or other assumed some different condition, is now a different entity from what it was, because the pot is there, well, that's not correct. As soon as you take the pot away, you see it's the same sky. Yeah. So these bodies, if we say the upadis are real, then that means that these bodies are real. That is what we're saying. Or in the reflective concept, then it means that that one Brahman is being reflected into many pots of water, and those pots of water do exist. And they are then the bodies. Okay, so in our commentary we say, defeating Parichedvad and Pratibimbavad, if the upadis are real. So, first thing is that even if the upadis are real, but Brahman is transcendental, so it can't be limited by them. If you say it can that they are actually real, and Brahman actually becomes divided by them, and actually becomes limited to them, then you are denying the fundamental definition of what is Brahman. Brahman cannot be limited by these things. So, then, it has the second point in the commentary, it is that it has no form, so it cannot be reflected. And these further points about it has no attributes, so it cannot have any relation with upadis. It is all pervading. It cannot be divided into a reflected object and its reflection. It's indivisible and uniform. It cannot be seen. So this is all kind of related to this concept he introduces at the end, that in these respects, Brahman is like the sky. How can you reflect the sky if you take a mirror? You cannot reflect the sky. It is not like that, because it doesn't have attributes of that nature. So it's unreflectable. It cannot be reflected also, because it's all pervading. In other words, it is basically everything. Then you cannot reflect it, because you could only reflect it in itself if it's actually all pervading. So that doesn't make sense either. And it has no attributes at all, as we understand attributes. It is simply all-pervading, formless, indivisible. It is just oneness, spiritual oneness. So it has no upadis. It cannot have any upadis. So like this, it can be compared to the sky. This is if the upadis are real. And then 38. Moreover, if there were empirically real upadis delimiting Brahman, Parichet, or acting as the medium of its reflection, Pratibimba, a person could not escape from them simply by knowing he is one with the Supreme in essence. And if the Advaita monists propose that freedom from upadis is due to the influence of the Supreme Entity who is called Tat, that, then they agree with us. This is a very interesting point. If the upadis are actually real, you really have a body. You are really in Maya. You are really in illusion. You are under the influence of the three modes, and they are real, and they have got a grip on you. Then it is not simply a matter of just saying that, well, I am Brahman, I'm not part of this. That is insufficient. That would be like saying, if you were really sick, you know, if you were really, really sick, completely knocked out, and someone comes and says, you're not sick, pick up your bed and rise, or whatever it is. So then you try and stand up, yes, I'm not sick, but then you'll just fall over again. You know, some years ago in South Africa, there were some Christian evangelists who were doing so-called miracle programs in public, supposedly curing people who were sick. And they would bring people up onto the stage. But most of those people were their own people. They were just acting like they were sick. But then the South African national television came, and they brought someone who was crippled and said, okay, now you do it here. And it was televised. So they did their whole, you know, feverish thing of Jesus, this and that, and so on and so forth. Now throw away your crutches and walk. He threw away his crutches and fell flat on his face, unfortunately for him, on television. Because you cannot just say, it's not just a matter of knowing, oh yes, I'm in Maya. If the upadis are real, and if you are actually really under their control, then it is not just a matter of knowledge. This is what they would say. It's just a matter of knowledge. You just know, oh yes, I am not all of that. But if it is real and your entangled position is real, then you have to deal with it by some real means. You cannot just talk your way out of it. And if that is the case, again, this is still 38. If we are assuming that the upadis are actually real, then you might, the Advaita monists might say that it is by the mercy of Brahman that you may get out of illusion. Then, indirectly, they are proposing pure Krishna consciousness, that there is a supreme entity who is capable of giving mercy, and if you appeal to that living entity, that entity, then he may give you mercy, and then you can be delivered. So indirectly, Jiva Goswami says that they are then agreeing with us, the devotees. So then on to 39. Now there's a discussion about if the upadis are not real. And generally, this is actually, from my understanding, more what the classic Mayavadis think, that the upadis are not real. Yeah. Although there are some who do think they are real. So, text 39. Conversely, if the upadis are only apparently real, they're not real, then Brahman's delimitation, being divided, parichedvad, or being reflected, pratibimbavad, are also only apparently real, since these processes would not in fact occur. Because in this case, the Mayavadi's doctrine would be based on the analogy of an unreal dream state, such analogies as that of the pot in the sky, which involve real upadis, cannot serve to establish it. No proper analogy can be drawn between something that exists and something that does not exist. Therefore, the Mayavadi's theories of division and reflection are nothing but the play of illusion, unprovable by their faulty application of analogies. So it is, the suggestion there is, if the upadis are not real, then it is something like dreaming. You may dream that a tiger is chasing you. So now you're in a world of fear. But actually, it's not happening at all. It doesn't even exist. So when you come out of that dream state, then that dream has no bearing at all on your reality. Has absolutely no bearing at all. Or you may dream, you may be very hungry. You may dream you're having a big feast. But when you come out of that dream, when you wake up, then that dream will have no bearing at all on your real condition. You'll still be hungry. So he's saying that if you say that the upadis are not real and the whole thing is a figment of the imagination, and that imagination is also not real, none of these things exist, then you end up in a situation where you cannot explain in real terms. You cannot present in real terms what is the position. So therefore you couldn't express it in meaningful ways. He says no proper analogy could be drawn then between those totally unreal things which don't exist and your actual real position. That's a different application of the idea. It's a different application.
Yeah.
There's a different application. Well, it's drawn between something that is real and something which is not real. But not in this case. Not in this case. It actually doesn't exist. We're just giving the example of a dream. Yeah. But it's even beyond that. We're talking of something which actually doesn't exist at all. You know, we can get some idea through the analogy of a dream, but it's not that the analogy of the dream, you know, perfectly captures the idea. We're talking about something which actually doesn't exist and trying to draw an analogy between that and a reality. So it won't work. It can't work just by definition. Then he really, in verse 40, sort of encapsulates the idea quite dramatically, really. In this way, by basing their ideas on Brahman and avidya alone. Because if you see there is Brahman, and the first thing that comes is avidya, ignorance. And everything else follows for that, including God or Ishwara. In this way, by basing their ideas on Brahman and avidya alone, the Mayavadis contradict themselves when they say that the one undivided Brahman, pure by virtue of being unadulterated consciousness, and thus altogether free from contact with avidya, is nonetheless polluted by contacting avidya and thus becomes the jiva. Then again say the Mayavadis, that same Brahman becomes the personal Godhead, becomes Ishvara, when he serves as the basis of Maya, which is the illusion concocted from the jiva's avidya. And under the influence of Maya, Brahman supposedly once more becomes the jiva. Here we have avidya within the pure spiritual being, Brahman. Vidya, in other words, that liberating force, knowledge, within the upadi called God, who is concocted by that avidya, and an illusory status of that same Godhead who is the proprietor of vidya. We should carefully study how these and other similarly manufactured ideas are simply incoherent. So if it sounds a little incoherent, that's because it is. Yeah. It doesn't really make sense. It's an attempt to kind of patch certain things together and draw connections between them where there are, the connections are not really there properly. That that they won't take it seriously if it's easy enough to understand. Yeah. Like I mention often from that song, I Am a Walrus by John Lennon. I don't know if you remember that. I am you and you are me and we are all together. So it's that type of thing, you know, that sort of sophisticated sounding, very tricky sounding type of statement. But if you really get into it, you see it doesn't make sense. So Jiva Goswami is calling their bluff. He's calling their bluff. And he's saying that it does not make sense. Recognize it. Let us just consider the points that he's presenting here. So we have Brahman. We have Brahman to start off with. That Brahman is undivided, pure, by virtue of being unadulterated consciousness, and thus altogether free from contact with avidya, ignorance. And again, remember, that is from avidya that this whole, all these other upadis are coming. It is not that the Ishvara is coming before avidya. He is coming afterwards as a function of avidya. As a function of avidya, in order to deal with the jivas. Yeah. He's not coming before as a function of Brahman. He's coming to monitor Maya and to monitor the jivas. So anyway, there is Brahman who is like that. So, somehow, that Brahman who is altogether free from contact with avidya, he is nonetheless polluted through contacting avidya and thus becomes the jiva. So, this is one of the points. He's saying there are many points which are incoherent and we should understand them. So this is a point which is incoherent. It does not make sense. It cannot make sense. If there is only Brahman and there is nothing else. See, the thing is, if there is Brahman and nothing else to start off with, then when it comes to the dividing people, or dividing or reflecting, it doesn't really matter. If the upadis are real, then where did they come from? If there is only Brahman, and Brahman is attributeless, that means Brahman has no capacity for manufacturing something real or even unreal. Then if you say it is unreal, then still, what does that mean? You still, you know, you're considering, even though it's not real, but you're considering it to exist. The example given in that regard, as far as the unreal concept is concerned, is the example of the rope and the snake. The rope in that example represents Brahman. So you see the rope and you see it not as the rope. In other words, you're seeing Brahman. So you're seeing the rope, but you see it not as the rope. You see it as a snake. Now, it is not a snake. There is no snake. There is no snake. There is only the rope. The snake does not exist, you see. So when they say Brahma Satyam Jagan Mitya, that Mitya, that means like the concept of the snake. It is false in the sense that it actually doesn't exist. But it exists somewhere. It exists in the consciousness of the person who thinks they see it. Yeah, even though it doesn't actually exist. So that is Maya, they would say. That the snake is Maya, but there is no snake. So that means that Maya doesn't exist, actually. This is if we're considering the upadis to not be real. You are seeing Brahman only. You think it is a snake, but there is no snake at all. It is only Brahman. But somehow there is some conception somewhere that it's there. Yes, well, this is the question. This is one of their serious problems. If the upadis are not real, see, if the upadis are real, then you can quite easily explain, you know, Maya and the jiva being in Maya. But if the upadis are real, then you have a very serious problem from the Mayavadi point of view. That is that it is not all one. There is Brahman and the upadis, if the upadis are real. So therefore, generally, they prefer the idea that the upadis are not real. Just like the snake is not real, there is no snake. It actually doesn't exist at all. So the Maya does not exist, in other words. But still it exists somehow in the consciousness of the perceiver. So how to explain away the perceiver and the consciousness of the perceiver? Well, this is very difficult. And actually, they can't really do it. So this is why Jiva Goswami is saying here that we should think very carefully about their concepts, and then we'll see that they're trying to connect these things up, but they fail to. They fail to. So anyway, where were we? We were saying that it is not possible that Brahman, being defined in that way, that it could become polluted by avidya. The possibility does not exist, and thus become the jiva. And then, because the jiva is now existing and needs to be managed, and Maya is existing and needs to be managed, and because the jiva needs now to get the opportunity to get out of Maya, then another part of Brahman has some contact with avidya and becomes Ishvara. And that Ishvara then controls the Maya. We're in the middle of text 40. Then again, say the Mayavadis, that same Brahman becomes the personal Godhead when he serves as the basis of Maya, which is the illusion concocted from the jiva's avidya. In ignorance, the jiva concocts a whole situation. That is called Maya. So here we have avidya within the pure spiritual being, Brahman. Vidya, or which means that knowledge which can liberate, the liberating force of knowledge within the non-existent, unreal upadi called God, called Ishvara, who has actually been concocted by avidya to start off with, because this is all following on from the jivas being that part of Brahman which has become the jiva, having become overwhelmed by avidya. So Ishvara is like a concomitant factor of avidya, even though he supposedly contains that force of knowledge which can give liberation. Yeah. And he is then an illusory status of Brahman, an illusory status of the same Godhead, who is the proprietor of vidya. Well, you could get lost in it. Therefore, he says, we should carefully study how these and similarly manufactured ideas are simply incoherent. They do actually not make sense. Yeah. So therefore, the Mayavadis, what they do, in fact, in order to try to connect these things up, to connect up that some part of Brahman which is completely pure, unadulterated, unadulteratable, has come under the influence of avidya and become the jiva. So they, what is their explanation generally? They say it is inconceivable. They say that you shouldn't worry about it. You should just recognize that you are in it and get out of it. This is their explanation, actually. It's not an explanation. You cannot bridge that gap, can you? You cannot. That gap is a gap. That Brahman, then the jiva, you cannot, in a coherent way, bridge that gap. So therefore they say it is inconceivable. Just accept it and just try and get out of Maya. And similarly, that the Ishvara, who is the embodiment of that knowledge which can liberate, but he has come about on the basis of the avidya. So again, they would say, inconceivable, don't worry about it too much. But the fact is, it is incoherent, and Jiva Goswami is pointing that out. How it really doesn't make sense. Well, we don't say it's inconceivable like they're saying it's inconceivable. See, they're saying it's inconceivable in order to just hide the fact that it's really incoherent. But in our case, you know, the inconceivability, generally, we apply that only to Krishna. Krishna's inconceivable. You know, there is achintya bhed abhed tattva, but it is not really, it's not inconceivable. It is largely conceivable. There are certain aspects where mundane logic may have difficulty with it, but transcendental philosophy can actually bridge the gap. It's not that you just go into some realm where it really doesn't make sense at all. Yeah, where it makes no sense. Yeah, through spiritual realization, that's a fact. The inconceivable becomes conceivable. And when the devotees hear about these things, then they don't just become sort of dull-headed and say, oh, well, we won't worry about it then. But as they meditate on these things and realize more and more how the Lord is acting and what is the relationship between the Lord and the living entity, then they become more inspired. It reveals the glory of the Lord. It's an inspiration. It's not just a matter of turning off. But what the Mayavadis are doing, they're just turning it off. That's all. Don't try. Yeah. In other words, it's an excuse to just cover up the fact that there is a hole. There's a major hole in their understanding. Well, Lord Shiva, first of all, he is the glance. He is not directly the Lord. He is just the glance. So there's a separation. Yeah. There's a separation. Yeah. And there's a separation. He is a specific manifestation, like separated manifestation, who is able to have contact through being separated and who is able to be affected. The Lord himself, you know, he is himself. You cannot separate him from himself. And he is absolutely so he cannot become influenced like that. But Lord Shiva, that's why Lord Shiva is his own tattva. He is actually of his own nature. Yeah. Yeah, he's a separate entity. So, let us move on, I think, to 41. Furthermore, if the jiva's absolute oneness with Brahman were the actual purport of Srimad Bhagavatam, Suta Goswami would have said that Srila Vyasadeva saw in his trance how the one Brahman becomes divided because of ignorance, or reflected, perhaps, and how knowledge dispels the suffering caused by this duality. And if the Supreme Lord's pastimes and qualities were unreal, what Sri Shukadeva experienced in his heart would be invalidated. But it hasn't been invalidated. He realized it. He came to that higher platform. And these great personalities, like Vyasa Narada, they recognized it. So, this is again based on 174 and 175. How Vyas saw the Lord, and then then Maya, standing a little back, under the control of the Lord, and then the Jiva, who was under the control of Maya. So, if it were actually one, then Vyas would have said that I went into the trance and I saw the one, Brahman, being divided up somehow because of avidya, or being somehow reflected because of avidya. And then I saw, then later on the other verses talking about how he sees some living entities being delivered. Then he would say that then I saw some of these illusory so-called jivas becoming delivered simply through knowledge, which is kind of the mode of goodness. It is not exactly Brahman as such, although it's very close to it. It's getting right up there. Therefore, it has some that capacity to elevate. And so, Vyas would have said that. Then I saw some of those jivas going back and merging, because they got hold of some of that knowledge from the illusory Ishvara, who was the basis for that illusory Maya, and who had arisen because of avidya and the need for controlling Maya and controlling the jivas because they're in avidya. But he didn't see that. He saw what the Srimad Bhagavatam says that he saw. And Shukadeva Goswami, he had a real spiritual experience through his realization of Srimad Bhagavatam, which brought him to a higher level of spiritual consciousness. So it wasn't that he went through some unreal, illusory experience. It was something very real. And he advanced in real terms because of it. And then 42. This is also a little on the tricky side. Therefore, scriptural passages that appear to favor such doctrines as Parichedvad and Pratibimbavad must be understood in a secondary sense. That is, as expressing some sort of similarity between the Supreme's relation to the manifest world and the ordinary processes of division and reflection. The ordinary processes. The Vedanta Sutra confirms this idea. Now, this is not an easy one to get. The water in a pond covers the land underneath and thus delimits it from the rest of the earth. But Brahman cannot be delimited in this way to become a jiva. So what are we talking about here? Pariched. This is Pariched. Then, so that is a doubt. That is a doubt someone is putting forward. Then the answer is given in the following verse, 3220 there. No, the reference to delimitation is appropriate, not in its primary sense, but in its secondary sense, that of the water delimiting larger and smaller areas of land. This interpretation fulfills the purpose of the scriptural passages, and thus it is appropriate to compare Brahman to land. So the first of these sutras gives an opponent's objection, and the second replies to that objection. Now that may not make a lot of sense to you, but what it means is that in the objection, 3219, The objector is saying that there is one Brahman. There is one Brahman. So if you say that just like water, if you have a pond of water, there is the earth above it, the same earth goes underneath and forms the bottom of the pond. So if you say that Brahman can be divided, just like the land has been divided into the land outside of the water and the land under the water, if you say that Brahman can be divided so that, in other words, the land under the water, I guess, has become the jiva, then no, this is wrong, because Brahman is indivisible. So that is like a direct understanding. But then the reply says that this is not appropriate. I mean, the objection is not appropriate. The reference to limitation is appropriate. The objector says that it's not appropriate to say that Brahman is being divided. But the response is that no, it is appropriate, but not in the primary sense. In another sense. Now, what is that other sense? The other sense is that there is oneness and difference between the jiva and the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Yeah. There is oneness and difference. So, on the transcendental platform, there can be division. Now, where are we getting that idea from? Let us just turn over to 43, and I think it'll become apparent. And, well, actually, just another point I could refer to there in 42 is that he is saying that this understanding is appropriate, that there is division between the Lord and the living entities. There is oneness, just like the land goes above the water and the same land goes under the water. So there is oneness. But if you say that now we have two types of land, or two types of living entities, or some qualities which the jivas share with the Lord, and some which are different, then that complies with the version of Shastra. That complies with the version of Shastra. Otherwise, if you say that the one Brahman got divided like that, it wouldn't comply with Shastra, because the Brahman, the Brahmajyoti as such, is indivisible. But on another level, the Lord and the living entities, then you can see oneness and difference simultaneously. So 43 basically explains this. I hope none of you are completely lost here, or too much lost at least. 43. Therefore, the scriptural statements instructing us about the non-difference between the jivas and Brahman, or you could say the Supreme Personality of Godhead, should be reconciled so as to agree with the conclusions Vyas came to in his trance. This is accomplished by first removing the apparent contradiction in the jivas being both different and non-different from Brahman. When you come across a statement which teaches non-difference, then we should understand that the jivas are one with Brahman, in the sense that both they and Brahman, or the Lord, are pure spiritual entities. So we are one in quality. While by Brahman's, by the Lord's, inconceivable natural potency, which makes even the impossible possible, the jivas are also innately distinct from Brahman or Krishna by virtue of their being his parts, like the infinitesimal rays of the sun's light, or, you know, the example of the leaves on the tree watering the root of the tree, that idea. So we know there are a number of examples given to illustrate oneness and difference. These lights, we have the light here, but the light is here It's all pervading in this room. But the light is there. So he's saying that sometimes you come across verses which seem to encourage some idea of pratibimba or parichet. So what you do when you come across those verses, or in other words, you come across some verses also which talk about how it's all one. You do. So when you come across these verses, then you have to apply. You have to apply the understanding gained through Vyasa's trance. That here we're getting a partial picture. Just one part of the spiritual situation is being described here. If it's saying that it's all one, the jivas are one with the Lord like that, then the purport is they're one in quality. That is the point. And you should take that point because that is consistent with Shastra. That is consistent with Vyasa's realization. Or even if you come across a verse which says that the jivas are absolutely different, then you know that it's just taking that part. You know, the Mayavadis, when they come across verses saying that it is apparently one, then they will say, right, this is it, it's here. We take it as it is. But when they come across a verse saying that there are the jivas and they are independent living entities, then they go into a whole mental spin how to somehow explain this in terms of Mayavad. And don't worry, they try their best to do it and they're pretty expert. And then when you get someone like Madhvacharya, you see pictures of him like this. Difference. There's not one, it's two. It's not one, it's never one, it's always two. Then when he comes across these verses saying that there's some absolute difference between Brahman or the Lord and the living entities, then he says, right, this is it. But then when you come across these verses talking about how it may be one, then Madhvacharya goes into some whole philosophical thing to try and analyze it and come to the point that it's two, actually, it's not one. But in our Krishna consciousness, our Gaudiya Vaishnava line, because we have this Achintya Bhedabhe Tattva philosophy, then when we come across these verses which are suggesting oneness or some reflection or some division, like this verse here, or this objection here, this statement in 42 about the water dividing the one land. So, we know Brahman is indivisible. So then we know this is not referring to the Brahma Jyoti as such. This is referring to the Lord and the jivas. They're the same in quality. Just as the earth above the water and the earth under the water, they're the same in quality. But you get this small amount of earth under the water, a greater amount of earth above the water, so they're two. They're two bodies of water. They have their distinct natures. So you have the Lord and the living entities there. Hare Krishna. Any comments or questions? Anyone who's objecting, anyone who thinks that it's all one, the objector, there's a completely hypothetical objector. Yeah, yeah. In a sense, we agree with the objection. But actually, it's not appropriate under the circumstances. Yeah. Yeah. No, it is a type of Vaishnava objection. It can be. It could be seen as such. It could be seen as such. We do not necessarily have a problem with the objection on the surface, but when we analyze it further, then we see there is a problem, really, because you have the Lord and the living entities. See, the thing is, this: the water in the pond covers the land underneath and thus delimits it from the rest of the earth. That is Shastra. That is, the Shastra is saying that the water in the pond covers the land underneath. The scripture is saying that. So the objector is saying that it can't be like that. But the thing is, the Shastra is saying that, so it has to be like that. So it is not that our goal is to now, you know, deny that the water in the pond is covering the land underneath or something like that. That is not our goal. Our goal is to explain how the water is dividing the land in such a way that it actually conforms, as the response says, 3:220. That we need an interpretation which fulfills the purpose of the scriptural passages. That is what we need. So, therefore, if the water in the pond, or if something is dividing spirit into two categories of spirit, so we have to now find how to explain that in ways which are consistent with Vyasa's realization, specifically, actually. So, to specifically conform to Vyasa's realization, we then say that yes, there is the Lord and there is the living entity. Unfortunately, the living entity is kind of under the water of Maya, because the water is Maya. Yeah. So the living entity has gone under the water of Maya and become affected by that. Even though in quality it's, you know, it's earth like the earth above. In quality, the living entity is pure spirit, like the Lord is pure spirit. Yeah. But he is a different type of spiritual entity, is the small jiva spiritual entity. So he can become affected. So this is the point, you see, that when you come across Shastra, which says things which seem to be pratibimba or parichayed, in this case, this is Shastra, it appears to be saying something parichayed, then you have to be able to interpret it in a secondary way. On the surface, it sounds like the Brahma Jyoti, Brahman in that sense, has been divided. But that aspect of spirit is not dividable. So therefore, you have to now look for a secondary type of understanding. Secondary in terms of the wording of the verse. The wording of the verse might suggest Brahman, the Brahma Jyoti. Yeah. But now you have to look for another understanding of that, so that your explanation in the end will confirm with Shastra. So what is that? There's the jivas and the Lord. Yeah. Gaunavritti, Mukhavritti. Their methods of interpretation. This is a very important point. This is an extremely important point. Actually, this is the point. This is the point here. The question is, what is the difference between our interpreting statements which appear to be clear in a certain way? Like this appears to be a clear Shastric statement that Brahman is divided, parichayed. But we are saying, no, we must now interpret this. Yeah. And not take it directly. So, we are doing that. So what is the difference between us doing that and the Mayavadis doing that? Because that is one of their main exercises. You know, twisting things to conform with a certain theory they hold. So now there's a very important difference, and this is the point, that our understanding of what is the actual message of Shastra is based on Vyasa's realization and Shukadeva's realization. Because they have presented it in terms of their realization. And their realizations are real. Their realizations are not just their mental speculations. Vyas actually realized the Lord. He saw him. He saw the jiva struggling. He saw Maya. He saw how they were related. He saw the process of devotional service. He saw the jivas becoming delivered through devotional service and going back to Godhead through devotional service. This is real. So, therefore, everything we come across in Shastra, it has to conform with that. And if there is some statement which apparently does not conform with that, apparently it is suggesting that there is a spiritual reality which is different from that. You know, like it's a reality which is all one, or a reality in which the Brahma Jyoti as such is divided, or the Brahma Jyoti is reflected, or something. Then, so where you come across these statements which contradict Vyasa's realization, then you have to interpret them so that they will then conform with Vyasa's realization. Otherwise, you know, everything falls to pieces altogether, actually. Vyas becomes useless. You know, we cannot, Vyas has no position. So then there's nothing. It's just us. You know, we just have to figure it out for ourselves. But we're in avidya. We're in avidya, whether we like it or not. So we cannot figure it out for ourselves. Do you follow the idea? This is very, very important. The realization of Vyas, and the realization of Shukadeva. They realized the reality. It includes everything. It includes everything. So when you come across statements which apparently contradict their realizations, then we have to understand that they have to be interpreted. They're being presented in a certain light, under certain circumstances. And to get the real gist of it all, they have to be interpreted to conform with Vyasa's realization. They have to. If they're outside of his realization and they're real, then Vyas has a problem. That means we all have a problem. The Vedic scriptures have a problem. But they don't have a problem. And the reason they don't have a problem is because Vyas has realized it all and Shukadev Goswami has realized it all. Dev was Brahman realized. He got exposed to Srimad Bhagavatam, to Krishna consciousness. So he then got realization from that. On the basis of that realization, his whole understanding changed. His whole perspective on life changed. And he became a pure devotee. Yeah. The question is, how do the Mayavadis interpret these two verses? Yeah. I don't think it's part of our course, really. I'm sure they have some way. I think they have many ways of interpreting it. But our interpretation given by Jiva Goswami is there in 43. Yeah, at least, you know, the sort of mechanisms for interpreting. That there is this other sense, which is the Lord and the living entities, not just the one indivisible Brahman. There is a difference between the Lord and the living entities, as well as oneness at the same time. Yes, Prabhu. Mayavadis? Well, generally nowadays you don't get many real Mayavadis. You get a few. But, you know, it's characterized in Shastra as being very dry. Just a mental exercise, you know, philosophical jugglery and all about Brahman and this and what is this and nati nati and what is not and so on. So therefore, Prabhupada said, they come down again. They generally come down again because it becomes frustrating after a while. Yeah. No real taste is there. So therefore they come down to philanthropic activity. They concoct a slogan, service to man is service to God. So you can serve Brahman by serving man. You know, it's easy to serve man. You know, it just means you get involved in the whole social scene again. But then you say, oh, it's all Brahman. You know, this is their idea. I'm still in Brahman. It's not that I've come down, but they have come down. They actually came down. Politics. Right. You get that. For tomorrow, can you read from 40 Mayavadi concepts? Don't really make sense. Trying to kind of squeeze them to see if they do make some sense. But they don't really make sense. So it's like that. Jai Srila Prabhupada Ki Jai.